This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today on our show, Adam Arvidson. He's the author of Wild and Rare, a book of stories about Minnesota's endangered species, including one in North Dakota as well, the piping plover. And Rick Steves, the traveler, the world traveler. He's a public broadcasting star, if you will. Dropped by our studio last week, but not to talk about traveling. He wanted to talk about recreational marijuana, which is, of course, legal in his home state of Washington. So you'll hear that today. But, of course, it's also membership week, and Ashley Thornburg and I have some important information to share with you right now.
And it starts with a phone number, 1-800-359-4145. That's the number to call to get a direct line into our studio here and talk to a volunteer about becoming a member or increasing your membership. You can also do this online at prairiepublic.org, or if you have a smartphone, you can text the word support to the number 484848. You'll get a link back. Follow that. And it is a simple process, but it really is the start of all that is possible here at Prairie Public. What is membership? It is you recognizing that instead of hearing commercials, we look to you for help making up that revenue. So you kind of have a choice here. Do you want a commercial station? And then that's fine. And if you're not looking for that, you tune to public broadcasting. But the recognition there that it's members who pay for that instead of advertisers. 1-800-359-4145. Click and join prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
We're not selling anything except really good ideas, we hope, or engaging conversation. You know, looking in great detail at important subjects. That's kind of what we're selling here. And if you're a listener, you are, interested. That is a reflection of that interest. And if you are listening with interest, maybe you should become a member, because members make it possible to listen. It's a simple equation, if you will, because we don't have those advertisements that Ashley was talking about, because we rely on you, the person listening right now, or the current member who might want to consider raising his or her membership, or maybe becoming a sustaining member to eliminate some of that paperwork that also costs money. You know, streamline the process. Lots of ways you can do that, but the important thing is membership is fundamentally important to this operation. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org, or you text that support to 484848.
You know, I was at an event this weekend where you could go around from one artist's studio to the next. It was called a studio crawl. And I got into a conversation with some people who were buying quite an investment in these local artists. And, you know, one line that stuck out to me was, you know, we got to make this possible so that they can keep working. I know these young college kids can't afford to buy this art, but they get to go on this crawl for free and learn about this, and then I get to help support. I didn't pay for this when I was in college, and I thought, well, that's exactly just like public radio. I didn't pay for this when I started listening to public radio in, kindergarten, first grade, right alongside my parents. But I did start to pay for it shortly out of college when I had my first full-time job, and that's the reason that it is here, and you are paying it forward for the next generation in thanks for the people who paid it forward for you to be listening. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
And joining us now is Adam Arvidson. He is the author of a brand new book put out by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. It's titled Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. Thank you for joining us, Adam.
It's my pleasure.
Well, this is an intriguing book. Let's just do some nuts and bolts stuff here first, though. Why did you write it?
Well, I wrote it because I've always had a real fascination with landscape. I grew up running around the outdoors all over the country.
You're a landscape architect.
I am a landscape architect. And so this was a way for me to look at the landscape a little bit more closely. Mm. I'm also a big fan of lists. And it really started by kind of finding out which were the listed, federally listed species in Minnesota. and thought that that might be a little key to unlock these landscapes. If I explored each one of them in turn, I figured I might learn something about the landscapes that they live in and kind of the relationships they have with humans.
Well, I was reminded that I've been around long enough to actually precede the Endangered Species Act, which was signed into law by President Richard Nixon in 1973.
It was.
What was it intended to do?
So the Endangered Species Act of 1973, it was the first time that there was some real teeth to protect species that were in danger of going extinct. Prior to that, there had been another law that recognized species and listed them, including North Dakota's whooping cranes, but it didn't really have many teeth to it. And then we're actually this year at the 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Treaty, which goes way back to protect species that were crossing national lines. But the Endangered Species Act, it was a critical time. There had been some very high-profile extinctions earlier in the century, the passenger pigeon, perhaps the most famous. And frankly, we were losing the bald eagle. And so there was a real effort to consider which of those species were going to be protected for the future, or were we going to allow them to wink out? And I will say, when Nixon signed that in 1973, it had actually passed the Senate 92-0. So this was clearly a bipartisan effort to ensure our natural heritage could remain.
Well, when I grew up, my father was actually telling his son stories about these passenger pigeons, and he had not witnessed them. He was born in 1915. They were kind of gone by then. But he had been told stories about these birds that blackened the sky. And, of course, I saw the DDT issue with eagles and other raptors, and now we see eagles again.
Yes.
So that's how does a plant or animal get on this list?
Well, the Endangered Species Act is designed for that decision to be purely a scientific one. So there are scientists in universities and departments of natural resources all over the country that are studying species and keeping an eye on what's happening out there. And when a species is sort of feared to be winking out, then there's really a scientific analysis that goes into that. And sometimes, unfortunately, it happens rather late. A pair of the species that are really interesting in Minnesota that also cross the boundary over into North Dakota are a couple of prairie butterflies that everyone thought were in no danger whatsoever. A small butterfly called the Powashiek skipperling was so common that naturalists weren't really noting it in their field logs. And now there are about 500 of them left in the world. It would be as if there were 500 squirrels left.
So what did these look like?
It's a very small butterfly. It almost looks more like a moth than a butterfly. They're orange and brown, and they do not migrate. They stay very close to home. They overwinter as caterpillars in the grasses where they spend almost their entire life. They really won't even necessarily migrate across a gravel road. So fragmentation of their habitat, their prairie habitat, is a real threat to them and may be one of the reasons that that they are in such decline. The Minnesota Zoo has actually been raising and propagating these butterflies and 2 summers ago re-released some back into the wild. So we will see if that can be a help. But again, part of that funding and part of that analysis comes from the fact that these species are now listed on the federal list and get the benefit of that kind of protection and often the funding that comes with it.
Does Minnesota have its own list too?
Minnesota does have its own list. Many states do with varying degrees, again, of teeth. But typically those state lists are very large. Minnesota's numbers into the hundreds of species. And sometimes a species may be rare in Minnesota but may not be rare nationally. So the federal list is really important to think about those that, that we think of as a nation of having a responsibility to care for.
What can endangered species tell us about where we live?
In my exploration of endangered species has been an interesting education, and this is one of the things that I try to bring through in the book is, you know, there's this adage where if you look for the really small things, you're going to see the big stuff. And I think sometimes these endangered species are the more unsung members of an ecosystem, of a landscape. And they're also kind of canaries in the coal mine. So if they start to drop away, we can expect maybe a cascade of other things to happen. But I think what's interesting is that these are all beautiful animals and plants. And without them, it feels like the landscape would be somehow less. And so to be able to go into the field with scientists, as I did, and see them up close, I didn't just get to notice these particular species that are in the book. It's really about the landscape as a whole and on all the many intricacies that make things special.
Do you deal with the issue of global warming in the book? Because we've just got the new dire forecast about that by, again, scientists, and it's at the United Nations. It's in discussion again. It keeps coming back. What is it telling us about the plants and animals that live around us?
Yeah, I do cover climate change in the book. There are several species that will probably be directly impacted by climate change. Again, one that has a direct connection to North Dakota, the piping plover, which is a migratory bird.
Oh, you're right about that one. Goes all the way to Texas.
It goes all the way to Texas, and I followed it all the way to Texas. I saw them in Texas. In fact, some of the birds that I saw in Texas had been banded there, and I know that they are North Dakota birds. So North Dakota makes a good appearance in the book in that sense.
Loons are pretty common along the Gulf Coast.
They are. That's where they spend their winters. Yeah. It just like some migratory humans do, I guess, go down to the Gulf Coast. But I actually witnessed on the Gulf Coast, they were having a very unusual winter with high winds that were pushing the tides up very high. The Texas coast is experiencing, has already experienced 3 centimeters of sea level rise, which is far greater than anywhere else in the world. The time when I was there to help do the plover census, the tides were extremely high, and the plovers were concentrated in very small areas rather than spread out across the mudflats there. If all of the mudflats do go underwater, there will be no wintering grounds for the piping plover, and they will be threatened with extinction.
Wow. And that's a bird that we can see here in North Dakota.
You can. You can see it particularly. It nests in the Alkali Lakes region and also sandbars and shorelines along the big rivers, the Missouri, the Yellowstone. That is a bird that you can see in North Dakota.
How would you characterize the value of endangered species? I mean, because sometimes they stop development, you know, because we want to protect a particular animal or plant.
Yes. I mean, I think there's three, and I write in the book, I think there's three really big reasons for me. And one of them is that some of these species are keystone species to our environment. And if we allow them to go extinct, the landscape will have other repercussions that may eventually affect us. If pollinators, bees and butterflies and birds, are going extinct, then that has a real impact on our food crops. So it's not just the natural ecosystem that could fall apart. It really has a direct impact on what we do. I think in some cases we don't exactly know, because it hasn't been studied, what benefit these species have in the landscape. And Aldo Leopold famously said, if we're going to tinker, I'm paraphrasing, if we're going to tinker, we should probably keep every piece. So we want to make sure that these are around because we may not fully understand their effect on the landscape. And the last one is really a question of responsibility. We're probably the first species in the history of evolution that has the ability to make other species go extinct. But we are also the first species that has the ability to stop ourselves from doing that. And I think that that's an important responsibility for us to think about: how do we perpetuate the natural landscape around us into the future?
You chose 10 plants and animals to highlight in your book, Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. This is Adam Arvidson, the author. How did you choose those?
So there are 10 chapters in the book. There are actually 19 federally listed species in Minnesota. That's the core of the book. Some of them are lumped together. For instance, there are 5 freshwater mussels that are listed. I figured they didn't each need a chapter, so there's a chapter on mussels. But I wanted to touch on every single one of them so that it is a complete list in a complete book. Many of those species, as I mentioned, do cross state lines. So there's quite a lot of Iowa and Wisconsin and Dakotas and even up into Canada in there. But the selection is the list itself.
And you spent some time working on this book because you wanted to travel where the animals traveled if they left the state, and you wanted to see these things in their natural habitat, right?
I did. I was out in the field a lot. The book took 9 years to write.
Wow.
I went as far afield as the Texas coast, as we've mentioned. I tracked lynx far up in the Minnesota's North Woods. I actually did boat up to Canada on Lake of the Woods to, again, looking for piping plovers. Kind of kayaked in the Duluth Harbor, and all these stories are in there.
Are you asking for us to take action with this book?
You know, for me, I never wanted to write the book as any kind of a political statement. It was really about illuminating the landscape that's around us that we may sometimes forget about. If there was an action that was worth taking here, I would say that since really the publication of the book, I mean, right up until the end of its writing, the Endangered Species Act itself has been coming under significant threat at the federal level. There's a lot of legislation that is passing through Congress right now that would decimate or significantly weaken the Endangered Species Act. For instance, there's a bill that actually is in committee right now that would simply delist all freshwater mussels for no particular reason other than they would not be considered an allowable animal to be on the endangered species list. So I've become a little bit more activist as this has published, and the only suggestion I would make is, you know, first of all, get out there and see these things and look at the landscape and maybe develop that love and enjoyment for it. And then I would ask your candidates for office sort of whether they feel as you might about protecting our natural heritage.
Well, you are a landscape architect.
Yes.
And we've done stories about bee colony collapse and things mm-hmm. like that, and maybe yep. putting in pollinator gardens, that kind of thing. Is there anything we can do, you know, as homeowners or
yes.
just as people who have a little bit of property to help endangered species?
Yeah, I think, referencing the stories you've done before about planting for pollinators, it's one of the biggest things that individuals can actually do. The crisis with butterflies and bees right now is extremely profound, and it's actually being found that sometimes even in our urban and suburban areas, there's better habitat for bees and butterflies than out in the rural areas, and it's because people are planting their front yards and backyards and mow strips and things like that, and I would definitely urge people to continue to do that. And to also maybe recognize that that's a different kind of landscape than we might be used to seeing in our cities, but to really start to get used to it and see the beauty in that too.
Well, when I was a kid, I never saw an eagle. Mm-hmm. Now I see eagles. So there is something to that, that they will come back if you allow them to.
they will, and the eagle is an example of the success of the Endangered Species Act.
You are a nonfiction writer.
Yes.
So what's next on your list?
I've got a couple of ideas in the works. I still continue to think about, both the history and future of conservation at once. I'm very intrigued by kind of how the ideas of American conservation came to be. I referenced Aldo Leopold earlier, and then how that applies to us today in a very different time. I'm looking at maybe some research on one particular big river in our region, and then also kind of looking at what impact writers have had historically on the conservation movement. But I don't have anything immediately in the works. I'm just going to enjoy this one for a while.
Adam Arvidsson is the author of Wild and Rare, Tracking Endangered Species in the Upper Midwest. He's appearing this evening at 7 o'clock at Zanbro's Variety in downtown Fargo. He'll be reading from his book, and of course, Zanbro's has it for sale as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What a great conversation that was, Doug, and I just love that we have the time to go into detail about this. 15 minutes on endangered species and what you can do to help a bee population or a bird population. You know, it doesn't sound like much. Get rid of some grass and plant some wildflowers instead, but it is making a tremendous difference. Boy, what does that sound like? You don't have to do too much to make a big difference?
Such an easy phone call to make.
1-800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org. And you can make that same little difference. I know it doesn't sound like a lot to say $10 a month, $120 a year. What can they possibly do with that? We can do a whole lot with that. We're creative and we've lived on a budget for a very long time. But more importantly, you're not the only one out there supporting us. You join a large pool of people, the Prairie Public family, who support this service and make it possible. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
Well, of course, we make this request a few times a year to remind you that we are member-supported radio. Why is that important? Well, you just heard an interview about a book with important ideas in it, endangered species, and the fact that the planet is warming and there will be more endangered species, including the human species. So it's important to stay informed. And the way you do that is to make sure that that information comes to you, and you can do that by becoming a member at Prairie Public. 1-800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org, or, as Ashley has suggested, text the word SUPPORT to 484848. More than 40% of our budget comes from members. That's very important, especially since a piece of our budget from another source, from the state of North Dakota, got slimmer last year. It might get slimmer again this year. So we've got to make up the difference somehow. It's not like we're awash in cash here. It's not like we're pulling down big salaries. This is a very lean operation. You know, public radio tends to work that way. Public broadcasting does. But that doesn't mean that members can't make it as good as it can possibly be, and that's what we're asking. 1-800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org.
And unless you have been living on the moon or in a cave at the bottom of the ocean, you know that it is an election year. And this year's midterms are very heated, especially in the state of North Dakota, as that Senate race takes a national spotlight. We have had people come to this state who, politically speaking, have never paid any attention to North Dakota, and suddenly National Public Radio, PBS, MSNBC, The New York Times, all sorts of news organizations are sending people to cover this race. Now is not the time to be able to scale back on our news coverage, if you will. Now is the time that we need to be putting in even more effort. And we want to do that. There isn't anybody here who isn't all sorts of hyped up about covering the news. That's why you get into this business. We can only do it, though, with your help. 1-800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org.
There's plenty of time to do it, but there's no time like the present. It doesn't take much time, so make that phone call, 800-359-4145. Coming up on Main Street, Rick Steves dropped by our studio last week, and he wasn't here to talk about travel. He wanted to talk about recreational marijuana. He was here to speak in favor of measure number 3. And we'll have other voices on this topic as well, pro and con, during the course of the election campaign. But that's coming up. First, though, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Communities across the country are observing Indigenous Peoples Day today, including the city of Fargo. This is Fargo's third observance of Indigenous Peoples Day. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney, along with other city leaders, was invited to a ceremony at Woodrow Wilson High School to mark the occasion. Members of the Native American Commission also invited representatives from each tribe in North Dakota to present their flags to the mayor, which will be displayed in Fargo's new city hall.
It's a great honor to get the Five Nations flags because that's something which you only are selected for as a community that really looks out for the Native American that's in our community. We're one of the few cities in the nation that have Native American Commission as part of our city government, and that's an attempt to try to work with people in our community and make sure things go as well. The Indigenous Day was suggested by the Native American Commission, and the commissioners agreed that that was a way they would like to remember this day.
Senator Richard Marsolet represents District 9 in Rolette County. He says the flags of the Five Nations have been presented two other times, both in Grand Forks and at the Fargo Air Museum. He says he's been trying to get them posted at the state capitol in Bismarck.
And I've been working on that for the last three sessions. But I found out that it could be the governor's executive order to do that. And the idea I got, I went to Helena, Montana, and went to the Capitol. And in the House and the Senate, they had 13 nation flags because they got 13 tribes in Montana. So that was really impressive to have those nations represented in the state capitol in Montana.
Mahoney says there are about 3,000 to 4,000 Native Americans who live in the Fargo-Moorhead area, representing each of the five North Dakota Native nations. Marsolet says the very first North Dakota Native Veterans Honor flight will take place later this month. He says 110 veterans will be taking the flight to Washington, D.C. on October 22nd, a trip that's been in the works for an entire year. State School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says she has a goal to make sure no North Dakota student enters college needing remedial courses. Basler wants to accomplish that within 5 years.
I really, truly believe that that is realistic because we have the mechanisms in place, we have the coursework, and we have the financial support to make sure that if they're not ready at the end of their 11th grade year, if they're not meeting the measurement or expectations that our university system is using, that we have a course that will specifically provide them the opportunity at their high school campus to earn the grade that they need to earn.
Basler says while North Dakota has an 89.7% high school graduation rate, the remediation rate is 27%. She says those students need remediation in math and or English. She says this is all part of the Choice Ready concept for students graduating high school. And the North Dakota Racing Commission had a study done of horse racing's impact on the state's economy. The study was done for the commission by NDSU.
Which showed that the industry provides about $24 million in economic impact every year.
Racing Commission Executive Director Gunnar LaCour says while that may not be a big number, it's pretty good for the horse industry.
Considering the Racing Commission itself has a budget of less than $500,000 and actually is a net return to the general fund every year. So we feel pretty good about where things are as far as the racing industry in the state.
The actual appropriation was around $389,000, and LaCour says halfway through the biennium, the Racing Commission has already returned $250,000 to the state's general fund. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
From your hometown to Capitol Hill, budgets are part of our everyday lives. I'm Elsa Chang. Taxes, tariffs, trade, the choices you make this November connect to all of them. When you give every month as a sustaining member, you help us cover the economic and political news that will affect you years down the road. Here's how to support the news you'll need tomorrow, today.
1-800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and joining us in our Fargo studio, Rick Steves. He is the host of radio and television programs on public stations across this country. Rick Steves Europe on television. Travel with Rick Steves on our radio network. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be with you.
And Rick, of course, you are most well known for the travel information that you provide, but you are in North Dakota for a specific reason. What brings you to North Dakota?
Yeah, I normally travel to Europe for fun or to make our TV shows, but now I'm traveling around the United States raising awareness about the importance, I believe, of stopping the prohibition against marijuana. And I've been doing this for 10 or 15 years now around our country, and I bring a European sensibility to the discussion, and I also live in a state which was the first state to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana back in 2012, where I was a sponsor, a co-sponsor and a funder and a spokesperson for that. And I like to stress I'm not pro-marijuana. This is not pro-pot. This is anti-prohibition, pro-civil liberties, and fiscal responsibility, among many other things.
And why are you putting yourself out there?
Well, we have a prohibition against marijuana right now, a law that's – the law itself is causing more pain and problems in our society than the drug it's trying to protect us from, similar to the prohibition against alcohol back in the 1930s. And when they finally decided to re-legalize alcohol in the 1930s – I don't think public leaders were saying booze is good. I think they were saying this law is causing more problems than the drug. Let's regulate it and let's tax it. And I don't think anybody would want to go back now to criminalize that intoxicating substance. I think we've learned that you can deal with it smartly and pragmatically. I do think that A lot of people are afraid to talk about this because they don't want to be soft on drugs, or they want to be reelected, or they don't want to have a problem in their career. I can talk about this because nobody can fire me. I run my own business. Nobody needs to elect me. Every once in a blue moon, somebody will say, Rick Steves, we know what you think about marijuana. We're not going to use your guidebooks or take your tours to Europe. And all I can think is, Europe's going to be more fun without you.
Okay. Well, you are from the state of Washington,
right,
which has had recreational marijuana for some time in North Dakota.
Right.
Of course, we're looking at measure number three,
right,
an initiated measure that would make recreational marijuana, right, legal in the state of North Dakota. What has been the experience in Washington?
Well,
I suspect there were
it was
controversial.
It was
there.
Scary back in 2012. And it really was a different environment because nobody had ever done this before. You know, the Dutch famously have their coffee shops and they can sell, they essentially retail marijuana legally there, but they never dealt with the backside, what they call the gray area. How do you wholesale it? How do you distribute it? They just didn't want to deal with it because it's just very complicated. Washington and Colorado decided to make this leap, and we did that in 2012. And back in 2012, Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado and Governor Inslee in my state were not in favor of these laws. Today, 6 years later, both the governor of Colorado and the government of Washington State are in favor of these laws. Again, not because they're pro-pot, but because they recognize, and the statistics bear this out. I want to remind you, you're going to have all sorts of pro and con people cherry-picking statistics here and a lot of money involved in keeping marijuana illegal because people make money off of marijuana being illegal. But our state is just interested in public safety and fiscal responsibility and respect for law enforcement. And after 6 years of legalizing, taxing, and regulating marijuana in Washington state, the statistics are in. Use stays essentially the same among responsible adults. Use does not go up, and this is very important among teenagers and minors. DUIs don't go up. Crime doesn't go up. What goes up is civil liberties, and what we've done is decimate a huge, thriving black market industry in Washington state that rivaled apples. And if you know Washington, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned it into a highly regulated, highly taxed legal industry employing tens of thousands of people. Last year in my state, we sold more than $1 billion of legal marijuana. Now, that's not because more people are smoking pot. That was a black market industry before, enriching and empowering gangs and organized crime. And now what we've done is we've really pretty much obliterated that market and turned it into a highly regulated legal market. And my governor, I just talked to him a couple weeks ago. He's so thankful he's not arresting 10,000 people a year that he would be otherwise. And he's enjoying more than $300 million of tax revenue coming into Olympia, our state capital, for health investment, for education, for drug treatment programs, and so on. And again, this is not because more people are smoking. It's because we took a black market industry and we decided to legalize, tax, and regulate it.
Well, let's talk about incarceration rates, because drug offenses tend to be a sort of high on that list of people who end up in jail, sometimes prison. So just talk about what can happen with incarceration rates.
Well, this is one reason why I'm on the road, is because in the United States, we have 70,000 people in jail right now for nonviolent marijuana offenses, and we arrest 700,000 people a year in our country. And it's clear they're not rich white guys. They're poor people and people of color that are being arrested. It's a flat-out racist law. And I think there's a lot of for one thing, it's just ethically and morally it's wrong. But from a practical point of view, you've got long-term indirect expenses of incarcerating masses of people. And it's just not smart. I think my European friends tell me a society has to make a choice. Tolerate alternative lifestyles or build more prisons. And then, Doug, they always remind us that you Americans lock up 10 times as many people per capita as we do in here in Europe. Either there's something inherently more criminal about American people or you've got some screwy laws.
Well, we do have – this is an expression of states' rights in a sense because yeah. You've got the state of Washington and perhaps the state of North Dakota going against the federal government because this is a Schedule I narcotic according to federal law.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good citizens that think, is this polite that we would be going against the federal government's prohibition? And I'll tell you, our system is designed where states are supposed to be incubators of change. When the government makes a federal law like they did against alcohol, they're not going to – and they've done now against marijuana – they're not going to say, oh, we screwed up. Let's change this law. It's up to the states who believe that the will of their people thinks that we should do it differently to challenge that law. It's incremental. Back in the days of prohibition, it was one state at a time. It was New York and just beer. Then it was liquor. Then it was other states. Then it was home brew. And finally, the federal government got the news that in the people of the United States don't want to lock up and criminalize alcohol. Today, the same thing is happening with marijuana. There's a rising tide of sensibility. The entire West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Nevada, Colorado, have legalized, taxed, and regulated marijuana. And it would be so exciting if North Dakota, which is a very sensible state, who believes in civil liberties, could be pragmatic about this. Instead of moralizing and incarcerating, I think it's time for a little bit of pragmatic harm reduction. And you can frame this in so many ways. You can frame it in states' rights. You can frame it in civil liberties. You can frame it in respect for law enforcement. You can frame it in a smart way to tackle the opioid problem. I could talk about it in all different ways, and I've learned a lot from my friends in Europe. The two most progressive countries in Europe when it comes to marijuana laws, the Netherlands and Portugal, both started their laws because they had a horrible opioid problem. And they have effectively dealt with their opioid problem by taking the soft drugs out of the equation and dealing with the hard drugs with credibility and focus.
Well, Washington, like North Dakota, has medical marijuana as well. So right. Talk about the the therapeutic qualities of this substance as it's used in Washington.
It's not even an issue anymore. Medical marijuana is accepted as a legitimate thing. It's not my personal crusade, but more than 30 states have legal marijuana for medicinal purposes. And I know I was just in Michigan talking about this, and in Michigan they've actually earmarked some of the tax revenue they're going to generate for veterans issues and PTSD issues because I think a quarter of all veterans are using marijuana as a medicinal way to treat their psychological and their physical problems that come from their service. And I just think it's, for one thing, it's pretty – it's just tragic that there are people who are speaking out against Measure 3 because it's good for their bottom line. You know, I've been on the road raising sensibility about this drug war against marijuana for 10 years now in states all over the country. I'm always up against an opposition, and the opposition is funded by what I call the PPP, the Pot Prohibition Profiteers, people who make money by keeping marijuana illegal. Pharmaceuticals, big beer, sheriff's unions, prisons for profit. These are the people that fund organizations called, in Michigan, it's called Keep Michigan Healthy and Productive. You know, that was the name of their organization. But what it's done, it is just fighting to keep marijuana illegal, keep locking up people for smoking it. And I don't know why pharmaceuticals are always spending a lot of money to make TV ads to keep marijuana illegal, but you can kind of imagine why.
Well, over the 80 or so years that we've had the federal law against marijuana, lots of people have been in prison. There are lots of folks with felony convictions because of this.
Oh, and I think the statistics in this state show that North Dakota citizenry smokes far less than other states per capita, but you arrest far more people per capita. You just have very effective law enforcement in this state. And I don't know. There's, you know, a lot of people are a little nervous about this, but a lot of people here are talking like it's 2010. And in 2010, it was dicey. We didn't know for sure what would happen. But now it's 2018. We know what will happen. And when you legalize, tax, and regulate smartly, use does not go up among adults. It stays roughly the same. Of course, you know, it's just – it becomes kind of boring. Grandma's rubbing it on her elbows now, you know. It's just – kids don't find it sexy anymore. I don't go to Hemp Fest anymore in Seattle. It used to be a very exciting protestival. Now it's just people don't care. People don't even talk about marijuana in Washington State anymore.
And you are talking about hemp, which has an industrial quality to it. I mean, you can make clothing other stuff.
This is a hemp bag right here, and I love it. Yeah. But, you know, it's very complicated to produce something made out of hemp because our country is so manic about its insistence in criminalizing this that we can't even use a material that you cannot get high on hemp, but it is still illegal because it sounds like marijuana. So, I mean, it's just – that's why I enjoy going around the country and talking about this. I'm not a scary guy. I'm just – I'm a hardworking, church-going, kid-raising, tax-paying American citizen. If I work hard all day long and I want to go home in the privacy of my own living room, smoke a joint, and just stare at the fireplace for 3 hours – that's my civil liberty, and I think North Dakotans can relate to that.
How many other states are you visiting on this? Like in North Dakota, it is an initiated measure on the ballot. Where you mentioned you've recently been in Michigan. Yeah. Where else specifically now that states have stuff on the upcoming ballot?
Well, Ashley, because I can speak out on this with kind of fearlessly, I can't. As I said, I don't need to be elected, and I don't need to worry about my employment. I feel like it's my civic duty to talk openly about this because I believe it's a big lie that we're embracing as a society. I was just in Michigan, all over Michigan last week, and people, leaders in the community, wanted to come to my talk, but they didn't feel comfortable coming to my talks because they didn't want people to think they were soft on drugs, you know. I talk all over the country, and this year Michigan and North Dakota are on my docket. I was just in Chicago because they're talking about it, not as an initiative thing, but as a legislative thing. I was on the Eastern Seaboard in five different state capitals talking about this. 2 years ago, I was in Massachusetts and Maine. I have just decided as a citizen of this country, and this is more than a state issue. This is a national issue. This is something I feel very strongly that even here in North Dakota, people should recognize that there's serious racism and lots of problems about this as a country that we're dealing with. And it's my contribution to our democracy that I spend a fair amount of money and 8 or 10 days every 2 years going on the road and talking about this. I do want to stress that a lot of people wonder, well, what motivates Rick? I paid for my plane ticket to get here. This is my contribution. I feel very strongly about it. And I also know for a fact that the people speaking against us are paid to be here by vested interests that want to keep marijuana illegal.
Well, you built your name, of course, traveling, going to Europe, writing the Europe through the back doors, running the travel programs. And obviously, mm-hmm. most people understand travel for relaxation, travel for seeing a little bit of art, travel for eating and what have you. But I'm really interested in this philosophy that you have about travel where you kind of consider it a political act.
Thank you. Yes, it's interesting. I've been teaching like a madman about European travel because I just love it so much for 30 years, and I didn't have any big agenda. I just love European travel, and I love teaching what I love. I've only done two things in my life. I taught piano because I love music, and then I've been teaching travel ever since. And in the 80s, it was all about cheap budget tricks, and my classes were Europe through the back door and that sort of thing, how to catch the train, how to pack light. In the 90s, I kind of elevated up this, what I see as a Maslow's hierarchy of travel needs. And okay, we got the train, we know how to pack light and stay healthy and eat well. Now we're going to talk about how to enjoy the history and the art and the culture. So I wrote a book called Europe 101, and I was all excited about teaching culture. And then since 9/11, I realized that the pinnacle of that Maslow's hierarchy of travel needs is traveling in a way that gets us out of our comfort zone, where we challenge truths that we were raised thinking are the norm, and we gain an empathy for the other 96% of humanity, and we come home with, I think, what I think is the most beautiful souvenir, and that's a broader perspective. That's what I call traveling as a political act. I know that Prairie Public airs my show occasionally, where it's my lecture about travel as a political act, and I'm so thankful that I work for public broadcasting, both in radio and TV, because in public broadcasting, we're driven – well, first of all, we can assume an attention span. I mean, this is a wonderful, lengthy interview here. And we can also respect our viewers and our listeners' intelligence. And we make programming driven not by a passion for keeping advertisers happy, which is the reality everywhere else on the dial. But here, in public broadcasting, we are driven by a passion for opening our audience up to the world and embracing life smartly and creatively and enthusiastically. And I love that. And as my role as a travel teacher, I get to go places and learn from my travels and bring it home. I went to Iran. I went to the Holy Land. Right now we've got a show airing all over the country. I think it's airing on Prairie Public about fascism and what we learned from that in the 20th century in Europe. And I'm going to Ethiopia next week and Guatemala after that to put together a new documentary on the fundamentals of world hunger that will air here on Prairie Public.
And so, you've been doing this for more than 40 years. And as you mentioned, you started small, but this has gotten pretty big. You've got over 100 people working for you now.
Yeah.
And you're doing shows on the radio, on TV, and online. I mean, this is an enterprise.
I'm running a pretty sizable business. I should be in my office putting our tours together and making TV shows and writing guidebooks. But no, I'm spending a week on the road because I really care about this drug policy issue, and I just am so I appreciate the chance to share these ideas with your listeners here in North Dakota. But my gig is to be the globetrotting guinea pig for American travelers.
Thank you.
When I get ripped off, I celebrate. They don't know who they just ripped off. I'm going to learn that scam and bring it home and share it with our public. And right now I'm bringing home this sensibility about not locking people up. You know, in Europe, and this opioid problem is a huge thing. 70,000 people are dying a year in our country because of opioid overdoses and so on. In much of Europe, the word for addicted is enslaved. Mm. And they don't see drug addicts as criminals. They don't need cops and lawyers and judges. These are sick people. They need counseling. They need nursing. They need some compassion. And that's what we can learn from Europe, is pragmatic harm reduction rather than moralizing and incarceration. So this is a very important issue. It's not pro-pot. It's compassion. It's pragmatism. It's respect for law enforcement. It's fiscal responsibility. It's anti-racism. And it's pro-civil liberties.
Rick Steves is the host of Rick Steves Europe on television. It's on our main channel Sundays at 3 Central and on our Lifelong Learning subchannel weekdays at 8 in the morning Central Time. Then Travel with Rick Steves on our radio network Wednesdays at 8 Central, preempted now through the Election for America on the Line. But it will be back, Rick. And thank you. And I hope you will be back as well.
I will be back too, I hope. Thanks so much and happy travels.
A lot of great, interesting points that Rick Steves has to make. And of course, would we ever just air the pro side of Measure 3? Of course not. We are having another guest on who is going to be talking about why to be against Measure 3. And we're actually inviting two more other people because this is a really hot button issue on the midterm elections, this initiated measure. And so at least two, possibly four different Main Street episodes here with long form civil engaged conversation about multiple angles of an issue like this, because we believe in an engaged electorate and an informed electorate. The number to call to support that is 1-800-359-4145. You can also send a text message to the word support at 484848, or you can click and join online at prairiepublic.org.
You know, I love doing this show, and I've loved all my experience in public broadcasting just because it does allow us, as you mentioned, Ashley, do these long-form discussions and put things in context. It's not the bumper sticker kind of communication that occurs in newscasts that have almost more minutes devoted to advertisement than news content. Mm-hmm. Actually, I used to produce these news shows. And so did Skip Wood in the control room.
And so did I.
And so, and we all know that the actual news hole was smaller than the advertising hole because you had weather and sports. And, well, you know, won't go into the stuff there, but you might actually, in a 30-minute show, have 8 minutes of news. So, and that would be a pretty generous day. That's different than here. I mean, we do four times that much, five times that much, virtually every day because these are important issues, and they require, you know, thought and discussion and detail, analysis. You know, we owe it to ourselves to get the best information we can and then make the best decision we can with that information. You help everybody do that when you become a member of Prairie Public because you allow this enterprise to continue. We wouldn't be around for as long as we've been around if it hadn't been for members. You know, listeners would not support us because listeners, you know, they're not invested in it. Members are. Show that investment. Give us a call at 1-800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org where you'll find all kinds of information, incidentally. That's a website with a wealth of information, including lots of news and the programming schedules for radio and TV, lots of stuff up there. But most importantly, it says donate now, and you can do that very quickly, very easily at prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848.
Or pick up that phone and call 1-800-359-4145 and think of this as an investment in programming that does a lot of things, but we'll start with wants to explore your curiosity and honors your intelligence and attention span. We're not talking down to you. We're not acting like you can't possibly listen to something for more than 12 seconds. Long form, thoughtful, engaging discussion is brought to you by you. The number to call is 1-800-359-4145. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org or send a text message to the number 484848. And that text message, very simple, just one word, support.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 8th. In the 1880s, the question was asked, how large will pumpkins grow in Dakota? The answer was, pretty big. The man behind the large pumpkin question was Joseph Barth, manager of the St. Paul One Price clothing store in Bismarck. Barth was promoting a pumpkin growing contest that would also promote the clothing store. In the month of May, 1886, Barth sent a free packet of pumpkin seeds to each farmer in the Bismarck area, along with a brochure for the store. Store manager Barth offered $100 in prizes. The gardener who grew the largest pumpkin would win a $25 suit of clothes. The second largest pumpkin grower would get a $20 suit of clothes, and the third largest would win a $15 suit. Additionally, a $10 suit would go to winners in four other categories: longest pumpkin, smallest pumpkin, nearest square pumpkin, and oddest shaped pumpkin. Hundreds of farmers answered the call, though many feared that early summer dry weather might shrivel the vines. Thankfully, timely rains fell, and pumpkin patches yielded a marvelous crop for the contest. On this date in 1886, the Bismarck Tribune reported that the store-sponsored pumpkin festival was a grand success. Farmers and families had traveled to Bismarck for a grand get-together in the local armory. Over 700 people came for a magnificent banquet and for the awarding of prizes. The largest pumpkin belonged to Fred Hollenbach of Bismarck, and he won the $25 suit of clothes. Longest pumpkin honors went to John Allen of Conklin, near Washburn. He got a suit worth $10. John Hitchcock from Burnt Creek had the smallest matured pumpkin, winning him a $10 suit. The nearest square pumpkin, grown by B.F. Gage of Bismarck, was also good for a $10 suit, as was the oddest shape winner, the award going to John Gragnerer of Buchanan in Stutzman County. The banquet was a feast of pumpkins made from the pumpkins entered in the contest. The main course was pumpkin griddle cakes, accompanied by baked pumpkin, pumpkin pudding, and pumpkin pickles, along with pumpkin sauce, pumpkin jelly, pumpkin meringue, pumpkin chocolate cake, and pumpkin jelly cake. The finale, of course, was a plenteous serving of pumpkin pie for all 700 people in attendance. Altogether, it was some pumpkins, as country folks used to say, at Bismarck's fabulous Pumpkin Festival in 1886. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pumpkincorn. That is, Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm John Harris, President and CEO of Prairie Public. I'm taking this opportunity to ask you to become a Prairie Public member for the first time. Renew your membership or offer my thanks if you already have done so. If you have been on the fence and thought your contribution wouldn't be enough, let me say it is. Whatever fits within your budget is more than meaningful to Prairie Public. Counting you as a member also lets other stakeholders know that Prairie Public has a strong community support. Most of our operating resources come directly from listeners like you, but we do receive funding from the state of North Dakota. Our state budget was trimmed significantly during the last legislative session. While there's uncertainty regarding the next budget cycle, as Governor Burgum has asked all state agencies to trim their budgets again up to 10%. That includes Prairie Public. Further reductions in funding could impact Prairie Public's operation significantly. So, the reliance on listeners like you becomes even greater. Give us a call at 1-800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org or text the word SUPPORT to 484848. Thank you for listening to Prairie Public, and thank you for your support.
Coming up on Main Street on Tuesday, Ron Smith will be here to answer some late-season lawn and garden questions. And at this week's Game Changer Ideas Festival in Bismarck, one of the featured presenters will be Caitlin Doughty, a mortician, activist, and funeral industry rabble-rouser. So that sounds pretty interesting, so I hope you'll join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.